There is a direct link between our relationship with God and our marriages. What's a Christian wife to do when her husband doesn't believe? What's a husband to do when his prayers are never answered? In his message, Godly Behavior Changes Others, Pastor Leith Anderson says, the way a wife treats her husband expresses her Christian faith and inner beauty and is a means to win him to Jesus Christ. The way a Christian husband treats his wife can determine whether his prayers are answered or not.
Fairy tales can be a wonderful part of childhood, especially the most famous line, which is the last line, and that is that they lived happily ever after. And so it is the wonderful view of the prince and the princess who have this romantic love that lasts for eternity, a relationship that all the rest of the world admires. When St. Peter wrote the New Testament, he wrote it as a married man. So he understood firsthand about romance, about relationship between a husband and a wife. He knew about Christian marriage and the inevitable challenges and problems that any relationship can have between a man and a woman. But he also observed the marriages that were going on around him. He observed what was happening within his country and within his culture. And he had to see that there were more and more Christian women who were married to pagan men. It wasn't so much that they married unbelievers as that they were married and the women came to Christian faith. In those days, men decided pretty much everything. They were the undisputed bosses at work and in the community and within the home. And so, in those days, if a man changed his religion, it was virtually inevitable that his wife and his children would also convert along with him. It's just the way it was. But just as that was a commonplace thing, it was virtually unthinkable that a woman would independently choose to change her religion without the prior consent of her husband. In fact, if she did, that would probably cause serious trouble in their relationship. And yet, there were many women who were hearing the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they were becoming devoted followers of Jesus. That often was a threat then to their husbands, and often jeopardized their marriages. When men became Christians, there was another issue. Not so much the issue that they were in trouble because they were doing something that was contrary to the culture. It was that from childhood, men in the Roman Empire had been trained to treat women poorly. It was pretty much understood that women existed for the pleasure of men and for the benefit of men. And it was considered by many to be a normal thing if a husband was abusive at home and promiscuous away from home. It was an everyday occurrence. In fact, it probably never came across the mind of most Roman men that they would ever need to or want to or think to treat their wives with respect, much less with equality. And yet, there were men who became Christians. Now, suddenly, they're supposed to behave as Christians in relationship to their wives, and there's a whole new approach. Because the Bible says that there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And there has to have been many a man who was just kind of overwhelmed by this new way of thinking, because his whole world was ordered by distinctions, racial distinctions, gender distinctions, slave and free man distinctions. And now he's being told that all are one in Jesus Christ. And he's to behave differently. And he has no idea how to do this. And he doesn't have very many examples that he can turn to. So it's not like there are a whole lot of other men that have a whole lot of experience that he can study. So it's with all this background that Peter writes the words that we find in 1 Peter 3, 1 through 7. Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is why the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, they used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So Peter starts out by saying, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands. And what he's doing is picking up the theme that he has just written that we studied last weekend from 1 Peter chapter 2. He was there arguing that submissiveness to others is a powerful instrument and tool for changing others. And the two examples he gives in 1 Peter 2 are in relationship to the government and in relationship to masters for those that are slaves. And says that you are to be the best of citizens and you are to be the best of workers. Because he's convinced that this is this powerful tool for Christians to impact and transform the lives and the behavior of others. What he's talking about is not a passive submissiveness, but an active submission that does good. I think the whole idea is kind of a cousin to the nonviolence that was taught by Gandhi, that was taught by Martin Luther King Jr. Anyway, Peter starts out by telling Christian wives to have the same type of behavior at home that transforms the government and that transforms the workplace. And the goal of all this is to see their husbands become Christians. If any of them do not believe the word, they may be won without words by the behavior of their wives. And so there is a play on words here, saying that if you want your husband to believe the word of God, to become a Christian, to do what the Bible has to say, the best way to do it is not by talking a lot. Now, it's not saying that you can't say what Jesus teaches, but it's saying that behavior is more powerful than any words that are spoken. In fact, Peter and the Bible here are placing enormous confidence in the power of behavior, assuming that if someone acts Christianly, that will powerfully impact the life of someone else. That we can actually keep our mouths shut, and by what we do, we can show other people what it means to be a Christian. Now, there's sort of an underlying assumption here, and the underlying assumption is that we want other people to become Christians. And the assumption is that Christians are, by commitment and by obedience to God, evangelistic. That is, that Christians have a desire to persuade other people to also become Christians. That Christians are like missionaries, like evangelists. That Christians are those who, whether in marriage or anywhere else in life, want to persuade other people to be Christians as well. Now, in this process of doing this, it's kind of interesting to see what Peter tells or doesn't tell wives to do. He's understanding that many of these women may be in extremely difficult circumstances. Here they become Christians, their husbands have little respect for Christianity and don't want to go along, in fact, don't want to give consent or permission for the conversion that has taken place. What she is not told to do is to divorce her husband. And probably there are multiple reasons for this. One is just very practical, that it was extremely difficult, if not impossible, under the laws of the Roman Empire for a wife to divorce her husband. A husband could easily divorce his wife, but not a wife or husband. But probably there's a better reason for that, and that is if she is to function as a Christian and impact the thinking and behavior of her husband, the only way she's going to be able to do that is if she's with him, if she's in proximity to him. If she doesn't have any more contact with him, then it's never going to work. She's also not told to insist upon her rights. Although the Bible is clear that wives, that women have rights, but that is not to be the primary emphasis. Probably because it wouldn't work, at least not in that cultural setting. And she's not told to talk him into it. In fact, to the contrary, it seems to be assumed that the less that is said, the better. And the axiom is accurate that actions speak louder than words. Okay, if that's what she's not supposed to do, what is she supposed to do? Well, very simply, she's supposed to be a good wife. And she's challenged here to be unselfish, pure, reverent, beautiful, and to pick a godly example. So number one, to be unselfish. And that's what submissiveness is. If I am submissive to you, then I'm putting you ahead of me. That's an unselfish way to live. Number two, she is to be pure. That is, that she is to be sexually moral and faithful, which seems kind of unfair because in most cases, at least in many cases, her husband didn't have that expectation on him as a pagan. He wasn't expected to have sexual purity. In fact, it was assumed that he would be promiscuous. But the whole point is that she was living by a different standard, and that she is morally pure for Jesus' sake, and that she is showing her husband a different way to live. She's to be unselfish and pure and reverent. That is, that she lives all of life in awe of God. She has this confidence, this trust in God. She's absolutely convinced that God is engaged in everything that is happening in her life and that he is dependable, that she can count on God to come through in her life and her marriage. And she's persuaded that God will use her to be a teacher of her husband. Unselfish, pure, reverent, and beautiful. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. Now, as you well know, standards for beauty, for hairstyles, for clothing and jewelry are different in every culture and in every generation. We know from the art that has been left from the first century Roman Empire that women in that century often braided their hair, that they put into their hair very expensive, if they could afford it, gold and silver combs, that they would also put jewelry in their hair that would decorate their hair, that if they had the money, they wore very expensive dresses. The in color in the first century for women's dresses was purple, you know, sort of embryonic Vikings fans that were anticipating things to come. And there are those who have tried to figure out in their culture what the equivalent value would be for some of the dresses that were worn. And among the wealthiest and most elite of society, they were thousands of dollars. One estimate for one first century Roman dress was as much as $1 million. So huge amounts of money were spent in order to look beautiful and to have that kind of appearance on the outside. Now, to be sure, the Bible here is not giving some kind of mandate that you shouldn't braid your hair, you shouldn't wear jewelry, you shouldn't wear nice clothes. But it is saying that a Christian woman does not major on outward appearance. That's not what she most wants to be known for. Sure, she should look good. Yes, that's great, and she should do that. But that she should spend equal or greater time on inner beauty and how she looks on the inside. And probably we all know of at least some examples of people who are just stunning to look at. You just don't ever want to get to know them, you know, because they're kind of obnoxious people. And then there are others who may at first seem to be very plain, but the more you get to know them, the more attractive they become. So the litany here is to be unselfish and pure and reverent and beautiful with special emphasis on the kind of person that she is on the inside. And then the fifth suggestion is to pick a godly example. And Peter offers one, and the one he offers is Sarah, who, by the way, was stunningly beautiful to look at. but was especially known for being a godly woman. I think there's a way to sort of think of what Peter is teaching, and that is, if you are a woman, who would you most like to be like? Who is the woman who comes to mind that you would like as your mentor, as your example? If you could be like anybody, who would she be? And if your answer is a Hollywood star or some famous celebrity, it's probably the wrong answer. That the first choice is a godly Christian, and that's probably the right answer. So the Bible's here saying, pick somebody. But pick your example well. Pick a godly woman that you want to be like. Now, the advice to Christian husbands is only 1/6 the length of the advice that's given to Christian wives. So the wives get 6 verses and the men get 1 verse. And there could be a lot of different explanations for that. It may be that the women had a bigger challenge to deal with in that male-dominated culture. And I certainly think that's true, but perhaps there's another reason, and that is that Peter seems to assume here that everything that applies to wives also applies to husbands. He's sort of saying, ditto, same goes for you, plus some extra respect. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect, as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So, Christian wives are to influence their husbands for good, and Christian husbands are to do the same thing, Peter says, in the same way. And when you think about it, that's really pretty cool, that here, if a husband wants to know how to relate to his wife, just look at the way she relates to him. Just copy her. And if she wants to know how to relate to her husband, just look at the way her husband relates to her and just copy it. Just do the same thing. That Christian marriage is very much about one person teaching the other person to be more Christian in our behavior to one another. But there's also a special emphasis that's placed here for Christian husbands, and that is to be considerate. That husbands are to work hard at being experts on their wives' needs and emotions and fears, dreams, expectations. One pastor had an interesting premarital counseling routine that he followed, and that is that through the years in meeting with couples and planning their wedding, he would give to each one a pad of paper and to each one a pencil. And while they both sat there with him, he would put them through an exercise. The exercise was this. You are each to write down the 3 things that your future spouse most likes to do. Really a pretty simple assignment. He said that his experience through the years was that the women were finished in less than 2 minutes while the men were trying to think of something to put down. And then he said that when he took both lists and read them, that the women were most often right and what the men wrote were most often wrong. So what is that telling you? I mean, it's saying here that husbands should be considerate. I mean, just know, to just listen, to check out, to find, to be an expert on his wife and knowing her better than anyone else does. To be constantly and clearly considerate of what she wants and what she needs. That every day is an exercise in the discipline of serving her well and meeting her needs. That the Christian husband is to respect his wife. So that means he listens to her. He honors her. It means he defers to her. It means that if she wants to speak, he lets her interrupt and that he does not interrupt her in return. That he communicates to her regularly, that she is the most important person in his life. And although she may be treated poorly by friends and relatives and at work and neighbors along the street, that one person who will always treat her well is her husband. And that he is to treat her well as a weaker partner, and by the way, this is not talking here about being spiritually or morally or intellectually weak or unequal. It is the recognition that most of the time the man is probably physically stronger than his wife, and so he is to use his physical strength to provide for her and to protect her, but that he is never, 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 never to use that physical strength to hurt her. The Christian husband is to relate to his wife as a partner, that they are partners and heirs of the gracious gift of life, that husbands and wives have been given life to share together, that it's a gift from God. And it's like a single gift, not one for each, but one together. That they are to be partners then, in joys and in sadness, that they are to be partners in strengths and in weaknesses, that they are to be partners together in failures and in successes, that they are to recognize that they are not perfect, that they will have enormous defeats in this partnership, and they will have wonderful successes to celebrate, that they receive the gift of God, this gift of life. And it's almost like an inheritance that is passed down to you, and you share it. You split that inheritance. You share it together. Now, there's one last bit of advice that is added by Peter that is both strange and wonderful. These are words that no Christian husband should ever miss, so listen up. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Isn't that an unusual thing to add on? So that nothing will hinder your prayers. What this may reflect is that husbands and wives are to pray together. Do you know that prayer together gives a bond and a glue to a relationship that is unlike anything else? That one of the most intimate exercises of all relationships is prayer together? That it enhances a relationship, it brings a couple together? That prayer together actually impacts their sexual relationship together as well? That the couple that prays together builds a better relationship, a better marriage, that there's a link that is here? And to be honest with you, in most relationships, if the husband is committed that they're going to pray together out loud, it'll probably happen. And if he is not committed to it, in all probability, it will not happen. So that may be, at least in part, why 1 Peter 3:7 ends that way. But I think there may be something else here. It is perhaps a hint of Peter's own marriage and Peter's own prayers. For I read his words and I think, why did he write this? And how did he know? How did he know that there's a connection between the way he treats his wife and whether his prayers are answered? And so I'm just guessing, but I'm wondering if one day Peter came home from his travels, doing whatever he was doing, and from wherever he had been, and he was exhausted, and he was filled with a sense of self-importance. I mean, after all, he was an apostle. He was a saint. He was busy writing the Bible. I mean, that's a big, important job to do kind of things like that. And so he was kind of grouchy toward his wife and inconsiderate. And at the dinner table, he was trying to decide, you know, how's this going to be divided up between 1 Peter 3 and 1 Peter 4? I mean, all of these important issues. And so he never asked her about her day or what things were like. In fact, he pretty much ignored her and was gruff toward her. And when he got up from the table, he never thanked her for anything that she had done. But he decided it was time for him to pray. And so, with great piety and self-righteousness, he went out the door into the garden. And there he started to pray. You know, it didn't work. It was sort of like a bad cell phone connection that day. And so, he thought if he prayed louder that God would hear better. But that didn't seem to help. And so, he changed his position and got down on his knees. And it was as if he was talking to himself. Becoming desperate, he laid on the ground, his face down, and he's pleading with God. It was kind of a waste of time. And he tried to think through, so what's the deal here? What's going on anyway? After all, remember that Peter was one of Jesus' three best friends. So he thought through their relationship, and it seemed he hadn't done anything that would hinder his prayers. And so he thought about theology. You know, was he saying the wrong kind of prayer? Did he pray the wrong stuff or in the wrong way? What was going on? Was there something the matter here? Because he wanted to talk to God. And then something occurred to him. He got up off the ground, or so I imagine he did, and walked back through the door and in to talk to his wife. And he apologized for the way he treated her. He said that he had been insensitive and self-absorbed and asked for her forgiveness. And then he asked her what happened that day and how things were going with her. And he gave the most important and precious thing any of us have to give, and that is ourselves and our time. And he heard her out. In fact, he decided to change his schedule, you know, for the next week. He'd give her some more time. He'd make her priorities his priorities. And there was an obvious change that took place in their relationship together. And then, perhaps before he went to sleep that night, he went back out in the garden and started to pray one more time and had one of the best prayer experiences that St. Peter ever had. It was like he directly connected to God, and that God not only heard him, but that God answered him. And perhaps it was the next day that Peter sat down with parchment and quill, writing not so much as Peter the saint, but rather as Peter the husband. And here's what he put. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. So what's the point of all this? Certainly it is how to be a Christian wife. And certainly it is how to be a Christian husband. But there's something more here. There is a principle that is bigger and even more important than wives and husbands and marriages. That these are words for all of the relationships of life in the best of times and in the worst of times. It is the principle that we can live in a way that will transform other people. How we live, our behavior, impacts and changes the lives of others. And so may you live. May you live in marriage, in singleness, at work, on the streets, at home. May you live in a way that wins other people to Jesus Christ. Our Father, hear our prayers. We don't want them to be hindered. We want to be able to talk to you, but we recognize that there is a connection between what we do here on earth and what you hear and answer there in heaven. Help us to be, whether husbands or wives, mothers or fathers, daughters or sons, whatever our relationship may be, may we be characterized by the kind of godly Christian behavior that changes others. Amen.
Wooddale Church is located at 6630 Shady Oak Road in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Please call us at 952-944-6300 or visit us on the internet at www.wooddale.org.
Packs a husband or wife. We've heard what Peter had to say about it in the first century, but now we hear about it in the 21st century. This evening's faith story, or for this evening's faith story, please welcome Scott Barsoom.
One morning in the fall of 1996, I woke up with a decision to make. How was I going to spend the rest of my life? I either needed to join my wife and family in their growing faith or be left behind. At the age of 7, while watching a Billy Graham crusade on TV with my mom, I started asking spiritual questions. And after we talked together, my mom helped me become a Christian when I asked Jesus to be the Lord of my life. I understood that he had died on the cross in my place so that I could have a relationship with him. And that decision, for me, was the easy part. As I grew older, I became cynical, and my faith became rote and distant. Within months of college graduation, my wife Shelley and I were married, we started a business, and my father announced that he was leaving our family. My parents' divorce left me feeling very much on my own, and my spiritual laziness left me unprepared for the harder times that were coming. Without a group of believers around us, and with life seeming very tough, I headed out on my own, still believing that Jesus was the Son of God, but deciding that this great gift was just too much work to put into practice. By 1994, when we were expecting our first child, a melancholy had settled into my spirit that was getting hard to work around. I had made choices along the way about how to make me happy, and now I wasn't very enthused about friendships or work. In July of that year, I got my first wake-up call. Our daughter Sophia was born halfway through my wife's pregnancy, and I found myself not only a father, but our baby was barely clinging to life and facing enormous medical challenges. God showed his faithfulness by bringing Sophia to health and by the outpouring of love and compassion of friends and family. I was startled by the kindness of those around us. Still, instead of rejoicing and being thankful, I found a new reason to be cynical. Why had this happened to me in the first place? My second wake-up call. My wife, Shelley, got the point. God had gotten her attention, and she had decided that her strength and her life were going to be anchored to her faith in Christ. She started attending Wooddale Church. I was annoyed. My third wake-up call. Our son Sam would have been a preemie too, except for Shelley's 11 weeks of hospital bed rest. Sam was born healthy. God had blessed us again. But why like this? Why was I at home taking care of Sophia while Shelley was in the hospital for 3 months? That takes me back to that morning in the fall of 1996, when I woke up with this decision to make. Shelley had become the spiritual backbone of our family, and she was finding peace and friendship through her relationship with Jesus Christ and the people at Wooddale. And then it hit me. I knew the Son of God. I believed that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. I wanted my kids to grow up with this faith. So why wouldn't I live this out? Why would I sidestep this power and this peace and this joy? So on that morning, I decided it was going to be all or nothing. I couldn't lay claim to this eternity-changing faith and then walk around like it didn't exist. I found out later that Shelley had been praying for me. And for those of you who are weary in your many prayers for those you love, I'm here today because of that faithfulness. Just as he did in Old Testament stories, God showed his devotion to me even when I wasn't paying attention. And now, I'm so grateful. I'm grateful to a merciful God whose love and power to forgive, I have no words to describe. My life is filled with many new friends and activities I have found since my recommitment to Christ, and I'm excited about every one of these opportunities. I am finding out that being a follower of Christ is athletic. Just walking around this church is athletic. I often rush through these halls smiling, knowing that the best is yet to come.